Domino's. Welcome back. I hope everybody enjoyed that first panel. I know I did. And thanks for coming back for our second panel. I think it bears prefacing this conversation by emphasizing what it is that we're talking about here, which is really, it's the ability to put food on your family's table. It's the ability to sustain yourself through hard and honest work. And it's difficult to think of any values or more, in some ways, uniquely associated with the American tradition. And so it's beyond surprising that we would have to constantly have these discussions about whether these rights are really worth insisting upon and whether the judiciary should be fully engaged in protecting them. I'm really excited to moderate this panel, in part because, as you move down the path of your career, you become more and more aware that it matters a lot who's coming up and who's going to fill the ranks of the next generation of people who are going to be fighting for the same things that you've dedicated your professional life to. I spent most of my career at the Institute for Justice litigating economic liberty cases. I'm incredibly passionate about that issue. And so I'm incredibly gratified to know that we have a younger generation of people who are thinking every bit as hard about that question of how to protect this right. They're doing so in a way that, as you'll see in a moment, is passionate, it's thoughtful, and it's creative. And it has to be because of the challenge in front of us. There was some discussion on the first panel of the distinction between what I called, in my book, terms of engagement, real judging and fake judging. And it's difficult to impress on somebody who hasn't actually stood before a tribunal, they haven't stood before a judge or a panel of judges, and had an oral argument in a rational basis case, because you would think that fake judging must be, it must be an exaggeration. Right, but it's not, and you realize that when you go in front of a court, especially if you've argued a case where there's real judging, like a First Amendment case, where the judges are asking real questions. They're like, okay, and they're asking real questions of the government. You actually have to, say something true, and you have to have some evidence to support your points. And then when it's a rational basis case, they don't. And what you begin to realize when you've had experience in with both of those kinds of arguments, the cases involving so-called fundamental rights and non-fundamental rights, is that everything depends on what hat the judge is wearing, or maybe a better way to put it is what glasses they're wearing. And if they're wearing the rational basis glasses, if they've convinced themselves that the case involves a non-fundamental right, you get a completely different dynamic and a different exchange with that tribunal than if they put on the other glasses. Oh, it's a fundamental right. Oh, there's heightened scrutiny. Well, I'm going to approach this case. And what you realize is they really can do it when they decide that they are supposed to do it. When I say do it, what I mean is apply something resembling actual judicial scrutiny to the case. And just to sort of underscore really quickly what that distinction feels like, the Louisiana florist law has been mentioned a couple times. I was the lawyer that first challenged that one. And Louisiana really does have a law that you have to have a license from the government to sell floral arrangements. They've watered it down a lot after being sort of embarrassed into doing so, but we lost in court. And I kid you not, the state lawyers in that case were arguing to the court that a conceivable justification for requiring florists to have a license is the physical dangers of unlicensed floristry, which any sane person knows there aren't any, but because it's a rational basis case, you can still assert it. As long as you can do it with a straight face, you can assert that. And there's a case that I've blogged or I've tweeted about before, and some of you have seen. Not a case that I litigated, but it was a case in Alaska, another economic liberty case, where there was actually a colloquy between one of the judges on the panel. It was a Ninth Circuit panel, and a DOJ lawyer in a rational basis case about whether invisible space aliens might be a conceivable justification for some laws. And it really went like this, could there be such a thing as invisible space aliens? Yes, Your Honor, I suppose there could. Well, then could that be a justification for the law under the rational basis test? I suppose it could. And so when you've got a judiciary that's prepared to approach a case in such an utterly unserious way, you've got to find a way to sort of knock them out, not that's probably the wrong way to put it, to entice them out of that mental of orientation and get them in a different headspace where they have a different conception of what their role in adjudicating this case is. And that's what each of the authors for this panel have done in a way that is fresh and exciting, and as somebody who's sort of labored in the often very unrewarding vineyards of rational basis litigation, I'm so excited to hear each of them tell you about the fresh and interesting approaches that they've come up with for how to get judges out of that mindset where whatever it is that your problem is, in this case, it's not my problem. And each of you have come up with a really interesting way to get judges into that better and more engaged headspace. I'm just going to do a really quick introduction because you're here to hear from these guys. To my immediate left is Ethan Blevins, who is a fellow at Pacific Legal Foundation. He clerked for our friend Don Willett, right, when he was still on the Texas Supreme Court, graduate of Duke Law School and a ukulele enthusiast, apparently, according to his bio. Next to him is Skylar Croy, who's an associate at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and was editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Law Review. And then Josh Polk, who's an attorney at Pacific Legal Foundation, comes to us from by way of Alabama, and you were editor-in-chief of the Alabama Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Law Review, right? So without further ado, Ethan, take it away.
Thanks so much, Clark, and thanks so much to Cato for this wonderful event, and I've loved reading my co-panelists' papers and excited to talk about it. The humblest individual receives the utmost protection under our form of government. That's a quote from a largely forgotten attorney named Joseph Heller, not the author of Catch-22, who brought one of the most unwinnable claims to the United States Supreme Court and won it in pursuit of his client's right to earn a living. And his clients were the humblest individuals of their time period. These were Jewish Polish immigrants with broken English operating a slaughterhouse in New York in the 1930s. There's a slaughterhouse theme. I was just thinking about this. Everybody's arrayed against them, it seems. And so it was with these men, the Schechter brothers. But these unlikely heroes had an unlikely weapon. And they used that weapon to slay one of the most ambitious pieces of legislation of the 20th century, the National Industrial Recovery Act, which was one of the darlings of the New Deal. And that unlikely weapon was the non-delegation doctrine. This was an idea that had never borne fruit among the federal courts prior to the year that this case was decided, which was the Schechter-Poultry case. Now, the National Industrial Recovery Act said that the president can approve these codes of fair competition. Not coincidentally, the codes were first drafted by the industries themselves, presented to the president, who then approved them. And one of these codes was the Live Poultry Code of New York. Now, the New Dealers needed a test subject for their new experiment, so they picked the most marginalized business with the least political clout they could, probably because they thought they weren't going to be able to fight back. They picked the Schechter brothers and slapped them with about 60 criminal counts under the Live Poultry Code of New York. Now, the New Dealers did not account for Joseph Heller, though, and his unlikely idea, which was that finally there's legislation that violates the non-delegation doctrine. The non-delegation doctrine says that the legislature is the lawmaker under our form of government, and they can't just pass off that duty to an agency or an individual, in this case, the president. And Joseph Heller won that argument. Now, to return to the quote I opened with, he said that the humblest individual receives the utmost protection under our form of government. I think those words were very intentional because he was emphasizing the structure of our government and the separation of powers, and that forms a fundamental bulwark for liberty. The Bill of Rights is important and essential, but we also need to remember that it's the structure of government that provides many of these protections. And the paper that Luke Wake and I present today argues that we can use the structure of government, specifically the non-delegation doctrine, and pull this unlikely sword from the stone in pursuit of our own clients' right to earn a living, just like Joseph Heller did. Now, the non-delegation doctrine has been cast out into the wilderness for a long time now, at least at the federal level. Many say it had only one good year in 1935 when the Schechter-Poultry case was decided. But it's experiencing a intellectual renaissance. The Supreme Court, a majority of the Supreme Court, has expressed interest in reviving it. Federal Circuit Courts of Appeal have made the same call. But perhaps most importantly, this renaissance has led to a lot of research about what's happening in the states. And it turns out that the states have very robust and meaningful non-delegation doctrines and that plaintiffs actually win under them. So we propose that we can use these state non-delegation doctrines to challenge occupational licensing schemes. Cronyism and delegation really go hand in hand, because we talked about embarrassing the legislature or a body into doing something right, but and the legislature is subject to being embarrassed. They have to make laws in a transparent, publicly accountable way. But they also want to cater to special interests. Well, the way they can do both is by simply delegating to an agency. They pass some relatively uncontroversial bill that says, we're going to regulate this industry, and they're going to make what this board can make whatever necessary and proper rules it wants to. They're the professionals. And then the agency, which is largely made up of industry incumbents, can favor the special interests. In fact, they really are the special interests. Now, there's two reasons why we think that non-delegation claims can succeed in challenging occupational licensing schemes. The first is what I just mentioned, that these boards are filled with industry insiders, and this is often required by statute. So we're picking on Louisiana today, but the Board of Cosmetology in Louisiana is an 8-member board. Every single member has to be a licensee and be operating in the state of Louisiana. In other words, this is a fully captured board. It's competitors regulating their competitors. Now, that's relevant under the non-delegation doctrine. One of the problems that we have in this world is we all know that these boards are captured, but it's hard to fit that into a legal claim as to why that would be relevant. Well, under the non-delegation doctrine, it is, and that's one reason why we think this is a meaningful way to pursue the right to earn a living. It's relevant because the courts have said that the motives of the delegatee, the body to whom the legislature is delegating authority, matters. If you think of, for example, to go back to Schechter Poultry, who was writing the codes of fair competition? The industries themselves that were to be regulated by those codes, except, of course, people like the Schechter brothers who were not in the room where it happened, right? So that's what's happening in these occupational licensing schemes, industries making the rules. That's a concern because we're worried that the body to whom the legislature is giving lawmaking authority is not acting in the public interest. And courts have said where the agency or the individual to whom the legislature has delegated power has, quote, skin in the game, end quote, to quote the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, then we're going to apply a higher level of scrutiny to the delegation. We've talked a lot about levels of scrutiny today, and non-delegation typically faces a similar problem to a lot of other claims, which is a high level of deference. But this non-delegation idea in the context of the occupational licensing has a way to heighten the level of scrutiny. That is, if the agency, which is the case in most licensing boards, is captured by industry insiders, then we're going to impose a higher level of scrutiny. The second reason why non-delegation claims have a real chance in challenging occupational licensing regimes is because of how broad and open-ended the discretion granted to these boards is. This is really the crux of any non-delegation claim, which is, has the legislature provided sufficient guidance that they're really still in the pilot seat, or have they really given it over to the agency by giving them such unbounded discretion they can make their own rules? Well, it turns out that in many state licensing regimes, they're effectively handing off the driver's seat to the agency. To go back to the Board of Cosmetology in Louisiana, the enabling statute that allows them to regulate the industry of cosmetology literally simply says they can make whatever rules they deem, quote, necessary and proper, end quote, to fulfill the purposes of the statute. Now, that's really no guidance whatsoever, because a court's going to look at whatever they do and say, is it necessary? Is it proper? Sure. I'm not going to second guess the Board of Cosmetology. They're the experts. So the board is allowed to do what they want, and you would not be surprised to know that they have used this authority to adopt all kinds of anti-competitive regulations for their industry. So those are the two primary reasons why non-delegation can really make a difference here. One, these boards are captured, so the level of scrutiny is higher. And two, we have largely unbounded discretion granted to these boards. We have a window of opportunity here. We have new research showing that states have meaningful doctrines. We have federal courts that are engaged with the idea of non-delegation like they have never been before. And now is a chance for us to draw this unlikely sword from the stone, just like Joseph Heller and the Schechter brothers in pursuit of the right to earn a living.
That's great. We'll look forward to coming back and digging in a little more. But right now, let's hear from Skylar with your extremely, I think, exciting idea for getting judges into a different mindset.
Oh, good. I'm glad that's quite the opener. So I will start out with this idea that there are stupid laws. I'm sure we can all agree on that. But not every stupid law is unconstitutional. So there's one that in particular that I want to talk about. This is an actual statute that is on the books right now in the state of Wisconsin. Quote, no guide license for hunting or trapping may be issued to or obtained by any person who is not a resident of this state. So my goal in the next 6 or 7 minutes is to convince all of you that this is not only stupid, but also unconstitutional. So the basic question here is whether a state can discriminate against a non-resident in an occupational licensing scheme. And the answer to that is no. And the reason why is because of Article 4, Section 2 of the United States Constitution. This is the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which reads, the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. It has not been well studied and has often been overshadowed by the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. What's curious about this, though, is that the Article 4 Clause has been held to protect economic liberty, but the 14th Amendment Clause has not. Why is that? So before I get into that, let me just lay out what the current doctrine is, the current jurisprudence for the Article 4 Clause. It's a two-step and arguably a three-step analysis, depending on how you want to break it out. Step one is you first determine whether there is a fundamental right at stake. Now, I realize we've criticized the term fundamental rights earlier today. I don't mean to endorse it here, but that is the term that courts use in describing this. If the right is fundamental, then the next step is whether there is discrimination between residents and non-residents and whether that degree of discrimination is justified. And what's interesting here is that this is intermediate scrutiny at step two. So this might be one of the few areas in the Constitution where economic liberty is recognized as a fundamental right, and I'll give some quotes for that in a minute. But we're not at rational basis. Interestingly, even though it's labeled as a fundamental right, we're still not at strict scrutiny either. So there's something a little odd going on there with this area of law. Now, the seminal case, whenever people talk about Article 4, they talk about the Corfield decision from 1823. This was a justice riding circuit, so it's not a U.S. Supreme Court decision. But as a part of this decision, there was a long, illustrative list of rights that were deemed fundamental for purposes of Article 4. And I'm just going to read one of them here because it's very on point. Quote, the right of a citizen of one state to pass through or to reside in any other state for purposes of trade, agriculture, professional pursuits, or otherwise. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly used similar language in the Hicklin decision from 1978. They said, quote, appellant's appeal to the protection of the clause is strongly supported by this court's decisions, holding violative of the clause state discrimination against non-residents seeking to ply their trade, practice their occupation, or pursue a common calling within the state. And to give a more recent example, the Fourth Circuit in 2022 considered a Maryland statute that directed counties to offer defaulted properties to a select class of people comprising largely those living and holding government positions there before listing the properties for a public auction. Three plaintiffs who were in the business of purchasing tax lien certificates and who were not in that class sued, claiming a violation of Article 4. They won. In their words, this statute violated the fundamental rights to own property and pursue a chosen profession. In the words of the Fourth Circuit, plaintiffs wish to purchase property largely for commercial ends which fell within the right to a common calling as broadly conceptualized in Article 4 Clause jurisprudence. Now, this line of cases stands in very sharp contrast to the 14th Amendment Clause, the Privileges or Immunities Clause that arguably has brought us all here today. And that is because there was a decision called Slaughterhouse. As my colleague here pointed out, Slaughterhouse seems to be the theme of all of these cases. And Slaughterhouse looked at this very similar language in the 14th Amendment and said that only protects rights that are of a national character. And it's not entirely clear exactly what they meant by that, but they did give a couple of examples. For example, the right to access seaports, the right to come to the seat of government, so where we all are here today, and the right to demand protection of the federal government over life, liberty, and property when on the high seas. But as we all know, among those rights that Slaughterhouse protects, economic liberty has generally been held to not be one of them. So the paper that I wrote with my colleague Dan Lennington at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty does a couple of things. First, it examines whether there's any historical or textual basis for that distinction and largely finds that there is not. The drafters of the 14th Amendment looked to Corfield as one of their supporting reasons for adopting the Privileges or Immunities Clause. And when you read those historical debates, you're not going to see this idea that there's only protection under the 14th Amendment for rights of a national character. And the second reason we wrote this was to try and develop a litigation strategy that might make use of this. So our first kind of call to action is that we would like to see people bring more of these Article 4 Clause claims, and preferably claims that have at least a somewhat national hook. So for example, not just a hunting guide, but a hunting guide who wants to engage in waterfowl hunting on Lake Michigan. That would be perfect. Haven't found that person yet, but if anyone knows a hunting guide in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan who wants to travel along navigable waters down Lake Michigan to Wisconsin for being a hunting guide, that would be great. And just to give a second example, in Atlanta, Georgia, there is an ordinance that prohibits non-residents from being taxi cab drivers. So the ordinance reads that applicants must be a resident for at least 1 year immediately preceding the date of application. That is basically the modern day seaport, but instead it's an airport. So the idea here would be to first try to bring Article 4 Clause claims, get some good rights describing language, some good precedent, and then ultimately try and use that precedent to advance claims under the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment and try to get the courts to recognize that there's not really a good reason to treat these this very similar language as differently as it has been treated. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much for that. And finally, Josh, what I loved about your article reminded me of something kids sometimes do to each other, where somebody grabs one kid grabs the other kid's hand and starts going like this, going, quit hitting yourself. Because you talk about antitrust and the possibilities that it has for challenging crony capitalism. And what's fun about that, right, is that antitrust law is a creature of statute. It was enacted as positive law by the government, which is also in the business of creating these occupational licensing boards that are themselves in the business of stifling competition. So tell us more about how we can use the government against itself.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Good morning, everybody. My name is Josh Polk, and I'm an attorney at Pacific Legal Foundation. Thank you, first of all, to the Cato Institute and also Anastasia and Clark for inviting me here. Today I'm going to present a strategy for targeting the captured boards that Ethan described using federal antitrust policy, which is usually the great Satan, but here not so much. Well, at least I'm going to make that argument. Yeah, whether you agree with it is up to you. So it's probably no great surprise to most of the people here, but the foxes are guarding the hen houses across the United States. There are approximately 1,800 state regulatory boards regulating everything from occupations to disciplinary actions, et cetera. And a full 85% of them are required by statute to have a majority of board members be active market participants in the regulated field. Worse yet, trade associations are often granted the power by state statute to have a hand in nominating board members. In some states, the governor can only nominate board members for state regulatory bodies from a list provided by the trade associations themselves. One real-world example is the Louisiana Interior Design Board, which by state statute must be staffed exclusively by active interior designers who are members of a particular national industry association. Apparently a common issue with Louisiana statutes and regulatory boards. The problem here is obvious, or at least it should be. Board regulations and enforcement actions stifle competition, often for the direct benefit to the market participant board members. And so there's a clear conflict of interest here. This is not just theoretical. Recent research by my colleague Steve Slavinsky demonstrates that the more captured a board is, the more restrictive the regulations and occupational barriers to entry. But holding boards accountable for anti-competitive behavior is often exceedingly difficult under traditional constitutional theories, which is why we're all here. Thankfully, Tim explained at length what the issue is with a rational basis, so I can be spared the pain and suffering of explaining it again. So I would like to present today antitrust law as a potential alternative or supplement to those theories that have proven somewhat difficult to effectively use. So as I sort of alluded to, and as Clark sort of alluded to, normally those who value freedom, innovation, free market should want very little to do with federal antitrust policy. The reality is that antitrust law is most often used to harm consumers by squashing innovation or protecting really lethargic companies that are allergic to difficult competition. But after the Supreme Court's decision in 2015 called FTC versus North Carolina Board of Dental Examiners, a pro-liberty application of antitrust law sort of emerged and was solidified. For those of you who don't know about the case, I'll just very briefly explain. Back when the Supreme Court issued its decision, the North Carolina Dental Board was composed of 6 dentists who were selected by other licensees and 2 public board members. Board members engage in an aggressive campaign of sending cease and desist letters to teeth whiteners. If you don't know, teeth whitening is a non-invasive, non-dangerous procedure, often just involving shining a light in somebody's mouth. But the board insisted that this was the practice of dentistry, and therefore they must go after the teeth whiteners for violating the regulations. Well, the FTC filed a complaint against the board, alleging that they'd engaged in anti-competitive behaviors in violation of federal antitrust policy. They tried to claim immunity, but the Supreme Court ruled that Parker immunity, which is basically state action immunity from antitrust policy, does not apply to state boards that are captured by private market participants. This was basically in recognition that there's a clear conflict of interest whenever state board members are participating in the markets that they themselves are regulating. And so after North Carolina Dental, in later cases, a state regulatory body controlled by market participants can be sued under antitrust law when there's one of 2 conditions. One, the challenged policy or action is not clearly articulated by the state itself, or 2, enforcement of the policy is not supervised by the state. It's really important then to strategically select boards that fail either one of those conditions. And I do have to say that the Supreme Court has not been exceedingly clear about what those 2 things mean and hasn't really had that many opportunities. That's what I'm urging all of you to give it. I think more specifically define those 2 categories, but it has provided guidance that will allow us to strategically select boards for potential litigation targets. For example, for a policy to be clearly articulated by the state, it not only has to be foreseeable that competition will be displaced, but there must be actual evidence that the state intended competition to be displaced. And then as far as state supervision, this is not a rubber stamp. There must be some active supervision by a state official, hopefully one that's politically accountable, like the governor's office or the AG's office, who will then sign off on any anti-competitive decisions made by a particular state regulatory board and ensure that the board is regulating in the interest of the public and not in the interest of themselves. And so if either of those conditions is met, then there is no immunity for state for the state board, and then you have to prove your antitrust claim, which I think is the hard part and why there hasn't been very many cases a la North Carolina Dental since the case was decided. I don't have time, at least in this initial presentation, to go into the detail about what has to be proven, but basically, under federal antitrust policy, you have to show that there was an agreement to restrain trade unreasonably. And often, because people are not saying, hey, you want to go restrain trade, you have to find circumstantial evidence that that's actually what occurred. And so that could be very difficult to do. But ultimately, the point of this presentation is that antitrust could allow Liberty litigators to remove power from interested regulators. But beyond that, there's also a legislative angle, because the prospect for a litigation victory in the antitrust sphere could also be used as leverage to secure legislative victories. To browbeat or gently persuade, depending on your style, state legislators into addressing anti-competitive boards and hopefully achieving some pro-competitive reform and pro-economic liberty reform. So there's a couple areas, I think, specifically that the legislature could address, and actually some of them relate to some of the material that was covered by Ethan already. But basically, the legislature could more specifically and clearly define board power and avoid granting vast discretionary authority to interested regulators. Next, the legislature could require real active supervision conducted by more politically accountable officials and offices to rein in anti-competitive boards. And states could also increase the number of disinterested members, thereby diluting the power of the market participants who are currently regulating the market that they have power over. And I'll just leave with an example. Leave you all here with an example, which is that we've already seen legislative success in this area when boards are out of control. For example, in Arizona, the state cosmetology board was essentially punished for its aggressive anti-competitive behavior. One thing that they did made the news. A volunteer was giving haircuts to homeless veterans in the park, and then he was investigated for practicing cosmetology without a license. The state responded by increasing the number of disinterested board members, thereby diluting their power and actually eliminating the majority that was held by market participants at the time. So long story short, I think that this could work, and I think it's really underutilized and a big opportunity here. So happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. So we'll have a conversation now, and let's sort of feel free to comment on anything you've heard so far that you saw in each other's papers. But I thought I would prompt it with a question to each of you, and I'm going to start with Ethan. I want to preface this by saying I really loved all these papers. They're all really well done. Yours was beautifully written, and I think I encourage anybody, if you just want to see like how you should write, every paragraph is a topic sentence. I knew where I was at all times. I really like your analogies. I'm an analogy guy. I love, and your language is evocative, so I'm going to just read this one quote here. Delegation offers legislators a tool for feeding special interests scraps under the table. Nice turn of phrase. Unpack that a little bit for us, and you know, explain to people who maybe don't appreciate sort of how the motives that legislators have, maybe sometimes to respond to special interests. This is, gives them a way to essentially pander to those special interests without paying the full political price that they might otherwise, right? So explain how that works with delegation.
Sure, that's a great and really important question. I think it goes back to a lot of our founders' concerns about faction, you know, that there would be these concentrated interest groups that have some particular legislation that they want passed, but the opposition is not as interested or not as directly impacted, not as organized. And so there's sort of this inequality in influence there. But the legislature's aware that it's going to, that it, you know, has some public accountability. They're going to want to shift blame and take credit at the same time. And delegation is this really convenient tool for doing all three of these things: catering to a special interest, shifting the blame, you can blame the agency later, and taking credit for what the agency does. Well, we passed the enabling legislation that made this possible. And I think that this is really visible in practice. I mean, this is what occupational licensing is all about. We don't want to pass, you know, we don't want to be seen as unpopular passing some kind of protectionist scheme. Let's let the agency do it. There's a great book written by David Schoenbrod, a very famous book about delegation. His example is marketing orders from the New Deal era. The marketing orders were technically done by the Department of Agriculture, but were in fact basically controlled by the industries. So the legislation said, basically, you know, make an orderly market. That's about as specific as they got. And then specifically, David Schoenbrod's example is navel oranges. It turns out that the Navel Orange Committee was just completely captured by Sunkist, which is a collective of various businesses. In fact, the employees on the committee were on Sunkist's pension plan. So this is a great example of how this very broad language allowed the legislature to avoid what would clearly be a problem if it was exposed to the public, the legislature's basically amounting to a gift clause problem, right? As they're just handing out, doling out gifts to Sunkist, which controls the market. But they're able to avoid all the blame for that by leaving it to the Department of Agriculture, which then nominated a committee, and then the committee is just under the control of Sunkist. So there's a lot of incentive to do this, and I think it's very visible in the National Industrial Recovery Act. Their whole idea was businesses should regulate themselves. It's going to be great. and then they could then avoid the blame for all the problems that come from that, but take credit when it goes well.
Great. Well, thank you for that. Skyler, One of the enduring mysteries about our Constitution is the use of this term privileges and immunities in Article 4, and then we get privileges or immunities in the 14th Amendment. In both places, it's not there by accident, but it's a somewhat idiosyncratic term. It's not one that I think the average reader has a lot of, doesn't have a lot of valence. So one of the parts of your article that I thought was really fascinating, and it was, I guess, a reminder for me, because I think I did know this at one time, but the principal author of the 14th Amendment, or at least Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, Representative John Bingham, had a somewhat different understanding of Article 4's Privileges and Immunities Clause than is currently reflected in Supreme Court doctrine. I wonder if you could take that as a kind of a leaping off point to explain, you know, why the privileges or immunities language was selected perhaps in the 14th Amendment, and the significance of the fact that the author of that provision, or the primary author of that provision, had a different understanding than the Supreme Court of Article 4 language.
Of course. So Representative Bingham did not think that the Article 4 clause was about discrimination at all. He actually thought it was a natural rights guarantee, very similar to the kind of natural rights language that a lot of state constitutions today start out with. And in fact, sort of an interesting historical example of this was when the state of Oregon was trying to become a state, and of course there had to be an Enabling Act passed, and the state of Oregon wanted to deprive black people of all sorts of rights and wanted to do it in its state constitution. Now, under a discrimination framework, this is not necessarily a problem under Article 4 because it's not about treating citizens of different states differently. It's about treating black residents in Oregon differently. But John Bingham stood up and gave a very passionate speech opposing Oregon's admission to the Union and argued quite explicitly that the Article 4 clause protects natural rights and is not about discrimination, but actually goes a step further than that. And this is a point that he repeats in speech after speech when you read the ratification debates surrounding the 14th Amendment. And there's also a couple of newspaper articles that were written around the time of the 14th Amendment's enactment that are cited in the paper and that also kind of take this view that the privileges and or immunities is a very broad concept. It incorporates the Bill of Rights, it protects unenumerated rights, it protects economic liberty. And this is really repeated throughout those documents. And just to emphasize this one more time, when you read those documents, the one thing that at least I did not see as I read them is anything that looks like a sort of slaughterhouse framework about national character or anything like that. I don't pretend to have done an exhaustive read of all of these documents, but that understanding did not seem to be there.
Great, thanks. Gonna get to Josh in just one second, but I wanted to say hello and welcome to our online participants, and also remind you that we welcome you, in fact, encourage you to submit any questions that you have through the event webpage, Facebook, YouTube, and Twix, Twitter, X, whatever it is these days, using hashtag Cato SCOTUS. I see that we've already got some questions, and we'll get to those in a moment, as well as questions from the audience. But my question for you, Josh, is I've always been somewhat flummoxed by this element of the Supreme Court test that there needs to be the intent to displace competition must be clearly expressed. And I wonder if you could answer it in the context of a specific application that came up in your article where, if I recall correctly, the Texas Dental Board sort of of its own accord took a position that in order to provide dental services in Texas, you have to do a physical examination of the patient. But that wasn't written in statute at all. I know that other boards, including the board that regulates doctors and veterinarians, requires the same. You cannot provide those services without first doing a physical examination. And it strikes me that could be interpreted as a specific intent to displace competition if it's in the statute, but I would assume the state would try to defend it as, you know, well, this is just to protect the health of you know, I guess the person's teeth or the body or the animal. So what exactly, I mean, can you tell us more about how the Supreme Court decides whether the intent to displace competition has in fact been clearly articulated?
So as I mentioned, the Supreme Court has not had very many opportunities to explore this question, but they have made clear that it can't be like how Ethan described, where it was you can regulate in the interest of the public or whatever, and that's enough. And so I think to get at what you're getting at, I think that's where the difficulty comes in, because they can say, well, okay, the statute didn't specifically say this, and so maybe we don't have immunity from antitrust liability, but there's actually no collusion going on here, and we're not trying to kill competition, we're just trying to protect the public. And so at that point, you'd have to find circumstantial evidence that this was, in fact, the result of a campaign to quash competition. But in that particular case, the state made no effort whatsoever to defend the board, and in fact, almost immediately after we filed our lawsuit, engaged in efforts to prohibit the board from requiring that. So.
Yeah. I want to ask one question. I think, you know, anybody who's done significant work on occupational freedom has, I hope, thought about this at one time or another, and that is the deleterious effect that over-criminalization has on occupational freedom and occupational economic opportunity. The questioner online said that something like 20 million people in this country have a felony conviction. That sounds about right to me. We don't need to quibble over whether it's 20 or 30, but you know, in many states, this forecloses many vocational opportunities. So the question was, is there anything in this discussion that maybe could be helpful there? And I thought I would kick that over. I mean, anybody can talk about it, but Skylar, I thought I'd ask about you about it first, because the current interpretation of the Article 4 privileges and immunities provision is primarily anti-discriminatory. It prevents states from treating citizens of other states worse. And judges seem very willing to do this, and presumably part of the reason is because they get that this kind of parochialism is very difficult to resist in the political process, right? You don't have access, or you're not supposed to have access, to the legislature of a state you don't live in terms of voting and so forth. And it seems to me there's a parallel there with people who are looking for work, but they have a felony conviction. In many states, they don't. They also don't have access to the democratic process because they've been prevented from voting by felon disenfranchisement statutes. So I invite you to sort of take it from there and tell us whether your program that you describe in your article might be helpful here.
Well, it's an interesting thought that I haven't considered fully. My first instinct is that, again, going back to that two-step framework that's used under Article 4, where you start out by identifying a fundamental right. Interestingly enough, fundamental rights in the context of Article 4 really do mean natural rights, and courts have effectively said that voting is not a natural right. Voting is something that doesn't predate government. It comes into being because of government. So I'm not sure how kind of going after voter disenfranchisement directly would work under that doctrine, but I do think you're right that it's identifying a group of people that don't have access to the political process in that particular state, and there may be some way there to kind of try and go back to at least what Representative Bingham viewed as the original meaning of the Article 4 clause, and to try to advocate for it there and say, look, this isn't necessarily about discrimination between residents and non-residents. It's about protecting natural rights and people who have been disenfranchised from the political process, analogous to the Oregon Enabling Act debate that I discussed earlier. I do also think there's been some movement in that area. In Wisconsin, for example, the legislature passed a statute that established a committee on offender employment. That committee is empowered to issue certificates of qualification for employment. And if a felon gets one of these certificates and a business hires them, they are given a pretty high level of immunity from certain negligent hiring claims that might otherwise go forward. So I do think that's an issue that is fortunately being looked at by a lot of state legislatures right now.
Yeah, I'm reminded that Justice Douglas was the author of an opinion that most of us know all too well, the Williamson v. Lee Optical. What a lot of people don't remember is that 1 year before, and so that's a decision where the Supreme Court essentially just abdicated any responsibility for pushing back against essentially efforts to predate the right to earn a living. A year before, in a case called Barsky, Justice Douglas wrote a passage in which he said, the right to work, I had assumed, was the most precious liberty that man possesses. A year later, he writes an opinion saying that for protection against abuses of your right to earn a living, recourse is to the legislature. There's an interesting, I think, thread here, which is that in the Texas threading case that we talked about before that IJ litigated, my recollection is that I think every plaintiff in that case, or maybe all but one, were non-citizens, right? So to tell them that they have to take it up with the legislature if they don't like the way their livelihood is being regulated is preposterous. You can't say that to a felon in many states. You can't say that to somebody who lives in another state. The through line, it seems to me, is that, again, judges seem willing to recognize that the political process is not a viable avenue for protection or reform in some settings, and in other settings where it is not either, they just miss that they don't see it, or else they tell themselves a story about how that might be an effective means of pushing back. So I invite any of you to riff on it, and then we'll take questions from the audience. But does that resonate with any of you? The judges seem, there's a weird kind of judicial cognitive dissonance going on here, where sometimes they seem to see that there really is no recourse, and other times they sort of fantasize a recourse where it doesn't exist either. Does that resonate? Josh, won't you? You're nodding, so yes, go. Feel free to flail away with antitrust or anything else.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, the reason why I was nodding along is I was just thinking, like, I'm not sure that they actually believe there is political recourse. I think that they just use that as, like, a crucifix to ward off, like, political criticism. I remember after the Patel decision was handed down, there was an article written by just some random local news station that was like, he's bringing Lochner back, and it was just really panicky. And I think that happens every time the courts take even a single step towards recognizing economic liberty, and I think they just want to avoid... that's just my opinion. Maybe it's amateur psychology, but that's
what you're
perception.
Here for, man. It's yeah. Cool. Anybody else? Anybody else want to sort of run with that, or do you want to take some questions? It's up to you.
I will say on the felon issue, it's very interesting, and if someone were to bring that, I do think in the right test case, that could be very persuasive. If it were the person who committed a nonviolent felony and it was sympathetic, it reminds me a little bit of some of the ongoing Second Amendment litigation that we have right now and that's playing out in the courts.
Maybe we can get Rod Blagojevich to move up to Minnesota and get into fishing guiding or hunting or something.
That'd be great.
That could be a fun test case. All right. So happy to take questions from the audience. We have one in the front row, and then we'll go to Anthony.
I was interested to know whether these policies that you're talking about could be applied to the right to work for employer without being required to join or support a union, and also the right to compete for government contracts without being required to require the employees to join or support a union as a condition of getting a government contract. So I've heard of the project labor agreements, and President Biden giving preference to people who are union shops or agency shops rather than merit shops.
Okay.
I'm wondering whether what you're talking about can be applied to that. Thank you.
Yeah, so interesting question. There is, of course, a somewhat separate line of Supreme Court doctrine that has tackled that question more precisely. But does anybody think that the discussion we're having on this panel spills over or has potential implications for, the overextensive presence of labor in some areas?
Mine might. Doesn't directly go to what you're saying, but in my paper I do talk about how in Wisconsin, and I presume in many other states, there are certain kinds of state employment that, for example, require someone to be a resident of the state. Mm-hmm. And in Wisconsin there are probably hundreds, if not thousands, of these positions. And if someone lived just across the border in, say, Illinois, and they wanted to drive to work a couple miles across the border into Wisconsin, they would be prohibited from that. And there's no, this is a kind of good point of doctrine for people to be aware of. Under the Article 4 clause, there's no market participation exception. So for some of you who know this, when you get into dormant commerce clause claims, there can be this idea that if the state is involved and is a market participant, there's differences in the doctrine, but there's no distinction made when the state is the hiring body under Article 4.
Anthony, in the fourth row.
Thank you. This is a great discussion. So, Skylar, I love you bringing up that fact about Article 4 during the ratification of the 14th Amendment, how is it understood? Because the irony of history seems to be that Bingham and others understood Article 4 to be a substantive protection, not a type of equal protection clause, and yet they were wrong. They really were wrong about the original meaning. And then when we look at the original meaning of the 14th Amendment, do we take that into account, or how does that work in? So this is kind of just a lead-in for you guys to bring up, whether we're talking about state constitutions or the antitrust laws even or whatever, how does originalism play into that? And should we be worried about that kind of double-layered originalism of the 14th Amendment when we're trying to work it out?
Well, I suppose I can start. So I would go back to the Corfield decision that I talked about, which I think is probably, even though it's 40-ish years after the ratification of Article 4, probably one of the better sources of original public meaning on it. And it does give a very exhaustive list of fundamental rights. And one of those fundamental rights is the ability to pass through or reside in any state for purposes of trade, agriculture, professional pursuits, so on and so forth. And part of what I'm trying to convince potentially courts and litigators of in this paper is that at least if we're willing to say that's a fundamental right under Article 4, it doesn't really make a lot of sense that we have a different understanding and a very different doctrine under the 14th Amendment. Now, I suppose one way you could go, and that sort of is implied by your question, is you could say that maybe the Article 4 precedent is wrong, but my hope would be that we can convince courts to preserve the Article 4 precedent and also start to look at the 14th Amendment, because of course the 14th Amendment does not have any, at least in the Privileges or Immunities Clause, anything about discrimination. It's not a discrimination-based requirement. So I hope that addresses your question.
I'll just say with antitrust law, Judge Robert Bork basically wrote an originalist defense of the consumer welfare standard in antitrust law called the antitrust paradox, which I do recommend. But other than that, I mean, most of the way that judges address antitrust issues is just invented by the judicial system itself. The Sherman Act might be the vaguest statute ever written, and so there's hardly any room for a textualist analysis there. And so the judges simply made stuff up until Judge Bork came around and his view became the prevailing one, but it doesn't have to remain the prevailing one. I'm just rambling here, but it's originalism does have a place, I think, in antitrust policy to the extent that antitrust policy must continue to exist.
Well, I want to close it out with a question we got online. I want to thank Cameron and W for this question. It's a really excellent question to wrap up with. I think particularly for this panel, because you were so much closer to the answer than some of us, including me. Cameron says, I'm a current law student, excuse me, and I'm the only law student I personally know who cares about economic rights. How do I change that? Let's come down the line. Why don't we start with you, Josh, and we'll work towards me. So what do you think?
First of all, I think stories and examples, we got a bunch of those from the first two panelists. I think they were really great, and I think that's how you change hearts and minds. But also, not just the poor grandmothers who are being put upon, but also the outrageous actions taken by the government itself. So one of the examples in my paper that Clark mentioned was when the State Dental Board of Texas tried to ban, without any sort of statutory authority, teledentistry during the pandemic. So they basically said, you can't go see your dentist in person, and oh, by the way, you also can't see your dentist over the phone. And I think that's obviously stupid and irrational, and I think stories like that sort of help us sell it to the public. So,
yep.
The Board of Bar Examiners is arguably one of the most abusive processes that anyone has to go through. And I will just say from personal experience, you will see a lot of people start to care about something that looks a lot like economic liberty when they're third-year law students. And I served in the Army for a number of years and had a security clearance. And I will tell you, getting a security clearance, even a high-level security clearance, is a lot easier than getting admitted to the bar. Maybe that's a way to kind of connect the dots for law students and help them see how this kind of stuff can affect them personally. And if anyone wants to sue the bar, please talk with me.
Great. Go ahead.
Well, I'd say more generally that our law, especially our constitutional law, is shot through with this Puritan notion that when you're in it for money, all of a sudden your rights are reduced. This is true in the First Amendment. If it's commercial speech, doing it for money, we're going to reduce the protection that applies to you. And it's in our statutes, right? There's charitable exemptions out there for license. It's okay for you to do such and such without a license if you're doing it for charity. If you're doing it for money, you have to have a license. And so I think we can push back against that by telling stories about people like the Schechter brothers, right? These are the people that are protected by economic liberty, not... Right, it's the who's writing the regulations under the National Industrial Recovery Act. It's not the Schechter Poultry, the Polish Jewish immigrants who don't speak English. It's the powerful, and I think that should resonate with law students. Right, these are people who should be, I think, in the political climate we're in, concerned about the little guy, and we need to help people recognize that the little guy is the one that's getting the short end of the stick.
Impossible to improve on those answers. Those were great. The power of stories and appealing to self-interest, it's a great combination. So thanks for that. Please join me in thanking Ethan and Skylar and Josh for a great panel and for the effort they put into their papers. And come back at 11:45. We're going to hear from Dr. Narang about entrepreneurialism in India. So thank you. Go have a break and come back at 11:45. All right.